everyone, and welcome to Minute 22 of Season 3 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action movie, Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me again today is Lil Eddie, formerly of the DCTV Report and Wicked Theory podcast. Welcome back, Eddie.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's great. Let's find out what happens with all these wires.
You know,
there's a lot of wires here. more wires than you would think, even in the 1980s. Who knows? Well,
hey man, big office building. There's a lot of phones in that building.
That's true.
So there's got to be a lot of phone lines.
Yeah, it's all the the Pacific Bell monopoly. So, Minute 22 begins with Tony continuing to search through the wires and ends with Carl making his way down the corridor with what looks like a blast shield over his face. reminiscent of something in Star Wars, maybe? Who knows? Yeah. We'll get there. We'll have to figure that out.
Maybe he's going to do some welding.
Maybe. Who knows? Maybe he's coming down to have a little more pizza with his brother. They were playfully dancing down their way. So in the script. So maybe here they're just playfully dancing separately. Down the corridor to basement level -2 or basement level 2. So, yesterday we ended things with Tony getting to the Pacific Bell treasure chest and opening up the cabinets and getting all of these various wires. And, so we get him continuing to start sorting through those wires. We're not really sure what he's looking for. Obviously, he knows what he's looking for. But, it's there's the saying a needle in a haystack, but here he's looking for a wire in a wire stack, and then after a second, the shot changes and we get to see John McClane's feet and he's actually making fists with his toes on the carpet, just like was suggested to him, I guess a little over a month ago when he was actually still on the plane.
Now, this right here, Die Hard, I have to say, in my opinion, is one of the perfect movies. There's only a handful of them. And this is an example of great screenwriting.
Yes.
This right here, just this whole idea, and I know this podcast focuses on the micro, but I just want to take one step back and do a little bit of macro here.
You can do macro. Macro is fine. Yeah. Macro is included in the micro. That's fine.
where you look at this story and we have this big action picture where a guy's running around a building trying to save everyone from these terrorists, and someone has the idea that this is going to be 10 times more challenging and so much more suspenseful if he's running around in his bare feet. But why the heck would anyone take off their shoes and socks in an office building? And so you start off, we're going to start the movie with him on a plane next to some smart aleck who gives this crackpot theory about getting over air travel by standing on a carpet, making fists with your toes.
Yes.
And we see that payoff right here.
Right. Now, I want to give you a little bit of background on this one that you probably didn't know. First of all, do you know that the movie's based on a novel?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Have you ever read Nothing Lasts Forever?
I have not. I have not.
So there is a scene, not at the very beginning, where the character, who's not John McClane, his name is Joe Leland. He's thinking back to the fact that someone told him that you should walk around on a carpet barefoot in order to get over tension. So, the idea comes from the original novel and they adapted it really well here. And like you said, they give us the first scene, where it's suggested, where it's just thrown out there and nobody expects it to show up later. As they say, Chekhov's bare feet, that type of thing.
Yeah. And it's the same kind of thing where, we're 21 minutes into this now and you've forgotten about that story.
Correct. No question about that. And and again, they give us 2 seconds of him playing with his feet on the carpet. That's it. The idea again is that we're going to forget about it. You don't care about the fact that he's here with his feet, making fists with his toes on the carpet in Ellis's office. And that's it.
Yeah. And he's laughing at how stupid this idea is and kind of marveling at, I guess it works.
Yeah. Now, I mean, my biggest problem with it, and I talked about this a few weeks ago, but I'll mention it again, is that, okay, he got off the plane, let's say 2 hours ago, 2.5 hours ago. Now he wants to get rid of his stress. Maybe it's because of his little argument with Holly. I don't know. But it's not from his problems from being on the plane.
Well, I think it's the first chance he's had since he got off the plane where he's had 5 minutes alone to himself and figures, I'm not going anywhere for a while. Let me just try that, see what happens.
Yeah, for sure. I completely agree with you on that. But I'm saying that he's not doing it because he feels tense. He's doing it because, what the hell? I have time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Holly has left me here while she's going off to give her speech. So, might as well, I got nothing better to do in Ellis's office. So I might as well just, make fists with my toes. And obviously from a screenwriting perspective, as you mentioned, it works really well. I mean, later this week, we'll touch upon this again. It's just the 2 second glimpse is great.
Yes.
Because if you know what to look for, you'll see it. That's basically what it comes down to, and then John goes, son of a bitch, and starts laughing and says, fist with your toes.
Yes, as like, he's wearing.
Who would believe that? That's his point.
Yes, as he's wearing that lily white, beautifully clean guinea tee T-shirt.
Yeah, yeah. That it's not gonna last. It's not gonna stay that white, but for now it is.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. It's like, if you've seen this movie before, you know what happens to that shirt.
Yes.
And it looks so clean right now.
Yes, completely. And then I noticed something here that I've never even thought about before. So John gets up, okay, and he pulls out his wallet from his pocket and opens his wallet. And so the first thing you see is that he's wearing his watch on the inside part of his wrist as opposed to the outside.
Yes.
Okay, so you see the face of the watch on the inside part, which, is very convenient if you just need to get a quick glance along the way. I think it's a military stance that people do it that way.
Yeah, yeah. I can also see, like, cops, sitting in their car on a stakeout. Just, it's more comfortable to have your hand and see the watch that way.
Could be. Mm-hmm. Could be. Mm-hmm. So then he's looking at his wallet, and the first thing we see in the wallet is the family portrait that Holly turned over, face down a few weeks ago on her desk. So we see, John, Holly, Lucy, and John Jr. And then he has like this little, it looks like a brownish card, which we're going to find out in a few seconds is actually Argyle's card, his business card. It looks a little more worn out than it really should, especially since Argyle just started working today. Who knows? Yeah. We can then see, then he picks up the card and we see another picture, and there's a picture actually of Holly with the two kids, and Holly is smiling. So this also says something about John. Last week we talked a lot about the fact, that Holly and John are in this rift for the last 6 months, because he stayed in New York and she came to LA, but he still carries around a picture of the family and a picture of her, smiling at him to make him feel good. I mean, if he doesn't want this marriage to work, he wouldn't be walking around with these pictures. He would just have pictures of his kids.
Yeah, yeah. And like, and that's something that's kind of, well, I guess, people don't carry wallets as much these days. I mean, I still do. But, I can even remember that was a big thing in the 90s, and I'm sure it was the same in the 80s where, the wallet, it wasn't just for carrying money around. You had mementos in there. My dad had like a bunch of pictures in his wallet. Those.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Like what type of things do you carry on your wallet nowadays?
I mean, really, it's money, credit cards, like insurance cards, and like business cards and little mementos. I might put in like a little thing from a fortune cookie or something.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah,
that's fair. I mean, I in my wallet, I have, like you said, credit cards, some cash. I also have a little piece of paper with a whole bunch of different details, about my kids and stuff like that, like date of birth and their social security numbers and things like that. So if I ever need it, it's there. It's all in one little cheat sheet, I guess you can say, instead of having to look for it, stuff that you need these days. I no longer have pictures in my wallet, but I used to, back in the day. I remember I'm a little bit older than you, since I was 14 when this movie came out. So I did have pictures in my wallet back then. I don't remember who I had pictures of. I was a 14-year-old kid. So maybe I had a picture of my mom. I don't know. I try and think about that. Like, who would I have pictures? Who would I have had pictures of as a teenager in my wallet? I do remember having, that it was something that always came with the wallet. The little plastic places to put in the pictures. Not like Fletch type of stuff, where it just like all, unfolds like it doesn't Fletch, but still. And I mean, in John's wallet, besides the pictures, you can see that he has what looks like an American Express card, and maybe another, maybe it's a phone card, or maybe it's another credit card or something like that. It's hard to tell because you just see the outer rim of it and stuff like that. So what do you think the history of a wallet is?
Oh, let's see. Wow, that's got to be going back. Yeah, I mean, it's got to be an evolution of the coin purse. Let's see. Was that would did it come in the 18th century? 19th century?
Okay,
How?
the word originated in the late 14th century. Okay, it was it which means either bag or knapsack, and it they're not sure where it specifically comes from. It either comes from a French word goulet, which means little snout, or from a Germanic word which is wohl, which means like a roll, to turn or revolve or something like that. Apparently in Shakespeare used it also. But he referred more to it as a backpack, as opposed to, a the but the modern meaning of a wallet, what we know nowadays, comes from 1834, which was known as a flat case for carrying paper money. The ancient Greeks had a word that was similar to it also, and stuff like that. I mean, again, we're not going to go that deep into it. But the one interesting thing I found about this is that how many different types of wallets do you think there are? Like, not brands or anything like that. Like, different purpose. How many different purpose wallets do you
Oh,
think there are?
I'm guessing probably dozens at least. just I mean, I could already think of like different types. You're talking like foldouts and or shapes of
Exactly.
it?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. So I ended up finding 24 different kinds. Now, again, I'm not going to go into all of them. That's just too much. But, as you said, you have the bifold and the trifold, and then you have what's known as a front pocket wallet, which is a wallet that doesn't have any place to put money in. It's just mostly for cards or banknotes, and you can like fold up money and put it inside and stuff like that. You have what's known as a money clip wallet, okay, which is has a clip that you can basically put money in together for it. Again, I'm not going to go into all of them, but you have like wallets that are known as checkbook wallets. They're the size of a checkbook, so that you can fit checks into them. Okay, you have an L-zip wallet, which is a rectangular shaped wallet with a zipper that runs along two sides of the wallet, which I actually used to have one of those, where you can like zip it up and then it unzips. Okay. Nowadays there are digital wallets, which is a computer file for maintaining digital currency. I guess you don't really need to worry about putting that one in your pocket. And
Everything's with the phone now.
the one that I found to be most amazing. Yeah, actually there's two that I found that are great. You have the automatic wallet, which is a wallet which has a mechanism that ejects inserted cards with a button to display them for use. It's also
That
known
could
as
be
a pop-up or a cascading wallet.
dangerous.
Yes. Well, it can also be used as a weapon. There you go. And the other one that I found is a tactical wallet, What do you think a tactical wallet is? What would be your
Tactical
guess?
wallet. Tactical. I mean, is that something, you'd keep on your belt or something like that? Or instead of containing money, it contains, I don't know, tactics or instructions or something like that.
Okay, it's a functional wallet that incorporates a ruler, a small saw, a knife, a bottle opener, and other tools. It's a thin wallet side multi-tool. So you can sort of call it a Swiss Army wallet.
Oh, that's got to be some EDC gizmo.
Who knows? But it's just very cool to know that there actually is something like that around.
You got you gotta love the everyday carry, folks.
Yeah, for
They have
sure.
everything.
Why not? I just like the idea of it. You have a Swiss Army knives aren't as useful today as we all thought they were when we were kids. But
Hey, it depends on what part of the world you're living in.
that's true also. Okay, that's true. There you go. But still. So it's great the way that they show him looking at the wallet, and then he flips the picture of the family portrait over. And we see writing on the back. First of all, we see opposite it another picture of Lucy. And then we see her a child's writing that says, "We miss you, Daddy. Love Lucy and John."
Yep.
Okay. Which also says so much because it means that he put this in his wallet because his daughter sent it to him. It's not that
Yeah.
he chose to put a picture of the family in his wallet. So, but he gets a nice little smile up from it. So it shows that maybe he's getting a little bit weepy from the whole thing.
Well, I mean, I could tell in researching this, I was just listening to John McTiernan's commentary on the Blu-ray, and he said it took halfway through the movie before they figured out like the whole point to the character of John McClane is that he doesn't really like himself, and this is one of those examples, of a moment where like he knows what he should have done, and he's angry that he didn't do it.
Exactly. And then we get another shot of Tony, who's still working at the with the wires, but now he has something connected to it. So we see that this case is he's connecting it somehow. I mean, I'm not a technical person, so I'm not even going to try and explain what it is that he's doing here. But what's cool is that you see that there's a readout within this little case. So you have different numbers that are listed there. So the bottom number says 1260, and then right after that, the next one shows up and it says 1160, and both of them switch into 1160. So it's I guess this is maybe a frequency that he's trying to find or something like that.
I think he's trying to
Yeah.
redirect everything so there won't be any outgoing calls.
Right. Exactly. Or incoming, I guess.
Yes.
He wants to, but he also, I guess, doesn't want people to know that there's a problem at the same time. We can see that he's working very intensely here because he's sweating, and he ends up, we see the type of work that he does. He takes two little alligator clips, puts them on the side of the wire, and then cuts in between them. I'm not really sure how that helps because if the idea is to make it that nobody will notice, so I don't know if keeping the alligator clips will work on that or not. Again, I'm not that technical, so I couldn't tell you.
It might just be something where he just wants to clamp down on the electrical flow between the wires so that, he doesn't get any kind of like static electricity or anything when he cuts it.
Right. No, but it's that he doesn't want someone else to figure it out. I don't think he's worried about himself, because we'll see later in the week how upset he gets about the whole thing. That maybe someone could, it's, he's not concerned about himself. He's concerned that someone's going to know that there's a problem. And then, we get another shot of John. He's back. First of all, we see that Tony's working really hard. No question about that. And then we see John pick up the phone and, dials the number on the card. And, he's waiting for it while it rings. And then we get to hear our good friend Argo. First of all, we hear the car stereo blast, and he's having a blast. No question about
Argo,
that.
I will say, if if you get to live Die Hard as any character in the movie, you want to be Argyle.
Up until he realizes what's going on. Once Argyle realizes what's going on, he's crapping in his pants.
Well, yeah, but I think even then, you know, I think through most of the movie, he's just hanging out there in that limo, listening. Nobody else knows that he's there. Nobody bothers him right. Until the end of the movie.
That's true. Yeah, that's very true. So he's
just hanging there with that giant teddy bear having a ball.
Yeah, that's right. He goes, "Hey Mac." He just goes, "Yeah, Argo. Hey Mac, how's it going up there? All right, where are you? I'm kicking it in the garage. What's the word with you and your lady, man? The book's not in yet." Yeah, so first of all, one thing I noticed, I've never noticed this before, is that did you notice that John McClane, or perhaps Bruce Willis, has a scar along his rotator cuff on his right arm? I mean, you can see it like at the 48-second. It's very interesting. I've never noticed because it doesn't look like it's just a shadow. It looks like that's like a big scar. You know, I didn't try to go into Bruce Willis's medical history to figure out if he ever needed something there, but you know,
yeah.
But it definitely looks like there's something there.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm just noticing that now. Oh, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, and Argyle, while he's having fun with this whole thing, while he's talking on the phone, I mean, when they show us Argyle, it looks like there were like flashing lights behind him. But I'm trying to figure out where those flashing lights are coming from. You know, does he have like a strobe light in the limousine?
I mean, he's in the same garage as the Pacific Courier truck.
Yes.
Right? So maybe those are just flashing headlights from the truck?
I doubt it, because nobody's in the truck anymore. Mm. And if someone was in the truck, they would notice that there's some guy in a limousine there, wouldn't they?
Yeah. You know, it depends on how far away it is. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, don't know. And then we get another shot of Tony back at work, and then we see even more digits on the displays showing his progress, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not really sure why some of the frequencies have changed, because we no longer have the, 1160 or the 1260. The number on the bottom is now 1973. So, again, I think they're just random numbers. I don't really think they mean very much. And then on the left-hand side, we can see some of the numbers partially obscured, whatever. And then we get a shot of Carl strolling down the corridor, you know, holding this big, helmet type of thing. And then he puts it on his head. And, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning of this minute, it looks like he has a blast shield. Maybe he's going to, you know, start trying to fight off some probes in the Millennium Falcon, you know, with his lightsaber.
Yeah, he's going to have fun.
Yeah, that's true. He's whistling. He's humming. He's having fun here. And that's pretty much how this minute ends. Did you have anything you want to say about the minute before we get into the script aspects of it?
No. I think we went through pretty much everything that's there.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So basically the script starts off with a little description of Hans. It says Hans looks at his watch and seems pleased. He steps into the service elevator with the others and presses the button for the 30th floor. The entire sequence has taken maybe 60 seconds. Now, we know it's taken longer, but still, you know.
Yeah.
And then it says, interior of Ellis's bathroom on the 30th floor. McClane is still barefoot. His pants legs now rolled up above his ankles. He stretches his toes again. Damn, it works. He lights up a new Marlboro, dials a number on the bathroom phone. You know, so, you know, they do mention the fact about making fists with the stoves here. And then it says, interior of the building basement, the phone room. A large sign says, Pacific Bell employees only. Inside, Tony stands in front of the intimidating matrix of phone lines. But what he has in mind won't require a doctorate in electrical engineering. Carl comes over, gives him an elder brother's punch in the arm, points out what to do. Together, they focus on four CPV plastic conduits, which run out of the main panel over their heads. Tony nods, opens a case, revealing a compact electric chainsaw. And then we go back to Ellis's bathroom, and McClane on the phone says, Argyle. And then we get a shot of the limo, where it says, Argyle is reclining on the seat. The music is on so loud that it is nearly impossible for him to hear. Hey, John, what's the word on you and your lady? The vote's not in yet. So, again, very minor discrepancies. I like the description of what Tony and Carl are supposed to be doing here. I think that's a great description. It's not something that you could really have in the movie, but, you know, the line saying that what he has in mind won't require a doctorate in electrical engineering is just great.
Yeah, and I like the way that they changed that Tony and Carl are separate.
Yes.
Because I think it better sets up the sibling dynamics between them.
Yeah, for sure.
And we're going to talk about that next tomorrow.
Yes, for sure. So those are the basic. And also another difference, Argyle in the movie calls John Mac, and in the in the script he calls him John. Again, minor discrepancy. You know, it could have been just you know, they decided to let him ad lib there, or who knows? Mm-hmm. Well, we shall never know. All right. So every Tuesday, we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track Holiday Edition, where my guest will give a little story about an adventure or misadventure that that he has had over his life that has some connection to a holiday trip or something that happened along on the holiday. So what have you got for us?
Well, the O'Hare household, I mentioned before, I come from a big Irish family. My father is the oldest of five on his side. And every Christmas Eve, we would all converge at one of his aunt's house for a big, giant Christmas Eve party, you know, where they would have seafood and pasta. And it was a big chance to commune with all of my cousins, and the way that they would organize it to make it simpler for everyone, instead of each family having to buy presents for all of the 10, well, it's 12 now, but I think it was 10 at the time, cousins. Instead, each of the five couples would get two kids in a grab bag, and so you would only have to buy two gifts instead of 10,
okay,
or 8, or whatever. But it was also you wanted to be very careful as to, you know, it was also a bit of a lottery for the kids, because you knew which aunts and uncles would buy good presents. I won't name this person because she's not part of my family anymore. But there was one particular aunt who had an affinity for buying clothes for everybody. And, you know, I can't.
And everybody can't, wanted her presence.
Well, yeah, no, I can't speak for it, but for young boys, you know, the kiss of death for Christmas or birthday is getting clothes. You want a toy. You want something that you could play with. Clothes, you know, I'm going to wear that whenever.
Reminds me of the Hanukkah Harry skit on Saturday Night Live. Have you ever seen that? With John Lovitz?
Yes. Yes.
Where they complain, you know, me being Jewish, I'm very familiar with it. They say, oh, now we know why Jewish kids get A presents, because they get all these, they get clothes all the time.
So there was one year where my cousin Mikey, poor Mikey, I'll make up a name. Aunt Lillian got little Mikey in the grab bag, and he saw her walking with this, you know, nice little you know, rectangular box that could only have been a sweater from JCPenney's, and it was probably a nice sweater, but before he even opened it, he saw her carrying it. Says, "Here, Mikey, Merry Christmas!" And he was probably 6 or 7 at the time, and he threw a tantrum, and he was so upset. No, she got me clothes, and it was so embarrassing. And my Aunt Carrie did not suffer fools, and I'm sure he got quite the talking to afterwards. But the good news is that Aunt Lillian got the message, and the following year, when she drew me in the grab bag, I got a nice set of Star Trek micro machines.
Ooh!
So it that's one of my favorite holiday memories.
That's great. That's a great story. Thank you very much for that.
Sure.
So you want to once again tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Yeah. I'm on Twitter at Lil Eddie O'Hare. You know, you could also listen to previous podcasts. I've done DCTV Report, used to do with Sarah Netsley, and I was on Bill Sweeney's Wicked Theory podcast. And I'm hoping to put together something towards the end of the year. So keep your eyes open.
All right, excellent. And finding me is very simple. All you do is a search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on my website. You can find me on Facebook. And you can find me on Twitter. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.